you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
I'm Austin Cross. Join me for LAist's new live event series with the James Beard Foundation. We Are Where We Eat will go behind the scenes of LA restaurants. The kickoff event is May 22nd. Tickets at LAist.com/events.
From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. The census and SCOTUS, two of the biggest national stories that have plenty of local ramifications. We'll dive into both right at the top of the show. Plus, enrollment at California's community colleges is declining. Find out why, if that continues, the effect on the state's economy could be disastrous. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Hi, I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, and we are back for another round.
This is clearly an NPR audience.
Yeah, I think they're so smart. What the hell?
My guests this time are actor Vella Lavelle and author Amanda Montell, whose new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, is out now. Join us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum for book talk, trivia, and hot takes. Tickets can be found at laist.com/events.
From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us. Later in the show, we're going to get perspective on the intense times we're in from someone who really has seen it all. Winnie Carter is 101 years old, and she's got a message for everybody who's eligible to vote.
They have an opportunity to vote, which was hard-earned, and they should take advantage of it because it didn't come easy.
Well, we'll start today with the big change on the Supreme Court. Over the weekend, President Trump, as expected, presented Justice Amy Coney Barrett as his choice to take over the seat left by the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, there have been a lot of debate over whether it's legitimate for the Senate to hold hearings to confirm anyone to fill the vacant seat this close to a presidential election. But setting that aside, there are some big issues that will be affected by a new constellation of the highest court in the land. We're going to get into those issues now with Professor Alan Ides from Loyola Marymount University, who was a clerk for Justice Byron White. Professor, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, okay, the Supreme Court goes back into session on October 1st. There's no way that a new justice can be confirmed by the end of this week, I think. Well, I think. Now, what happens right away with an 8-person Supreme Court? Why can't we continue with 8 justices for a while? Didn't we do that a few years ago?
Yes, we did. And we can continue with 8 justices. There's always a risk that they'll split 4-4. And that would mean the lower court would be affirmed, or they could put the case on the back burner and wait till the new justice was appointed and re-argue the case. So most of the cases that are pending before the court aren't of the type that you expect to be very controversial. So they can move right through those cases.
So just to be clear, a split vote means the lower court gets affirmed.
If the court announces the judgment of a split vote, but they have the option of not announcing that and just holding on to the case until another justice is appointed.
Okay, so business can still be done then. I guess that's the point we're trying to get to, right?
Absolutely. Business will be proceeding as usual.
Now, the Women's March will take to the streets of D.C. in October to protest the replacement of Ginsburg this close to the election. But, Professor, what sort of power, if any, does the public have at this point over the Senate?
Only to the extent they could influence one of the senators how he or she should vote. Essentially, they have no power. Theoretically, the Women's March could influence somebody to, on the Republican side, to not vote or to vote no. But that's really all they have. The most powerful weapon I think the public has, if they object to this, is voting. It's like the message you just gave. Vote and support only those senators that have taken a position that you think is the sensible one under these circumstances.
So if the senators just choose to insulate themselves from any outside pressure, any outside influence, that's just how it'll be.
That's how it'll be.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about Judge Amy Coney Barrett for a second. What do you know about her orientation as a thinker and a justice?
Well, I think clearly her orientation is toward the Scalia model, which is conservative, but is premised on what they like to call textualism in the original understanding. And that is really just a form of argument. And it is has been used successfully by Scalia and other members of the court to take the court in a more conservative direction.
So it's an interpretation then is what we're talking about.
It is really an interpretation. And it's very interesting that probably the most famous case is District of Columbia versus Heller, the gun rights case. And Justice Scalia wrote an opinion for a 5-person majority using original intent as a basis for finding the right to own a firearm in the home. And Justice Stevens, for 4 people in dissent, used originalism to come up with the exact opposite conclusion. So originalism is a way of arguing a case, but it is not necessarily going to lead to any particular conclusion because it depends in part on the art of the arguer. Have they convinced you that this was the original understanding? Because you can imagine it's not that easy to ferret out the original understanding that people had in 1789 or 1867.
Yeah, of course not. I mean, that's where it becomes almost a matter of opinion in a weird way. So what's the rationale, Professor, behind President Trump nominating Barrett?
So, I mean, to be fair, I don't think he has a judicial philosophy or something he's trying to promote. He knows that she reflects the views of his base, and he wanted to pick somebody who would be consistent with those views. It's, his way of making good on his campaign promise to put conservative members on the Supreme Court.
In this particular case, Professor, is it reflecting the conservative views of his base or the religious views of his base, you think?
Well, probably both, though I would imagine the religious views of his base are diverse. I don't think they're all fundamentalist Catholics. They're evangelicals and, a wide range of different beliefs. So I think it's more to reflect. The public has this idea that if courts are just true to the text and the original understanding, we'll always achieve the correct result. And it's an oversimplified version of what really happens in a case. And so he's selling that we'll return to better times if we just do what James Madison would have done in, 1792. And so people find that attractive.
Talking to Professor Alan Ides at Loyola Marymount University. Now, we know the Supreme Court is going to see a case soon that involves the Affordable Care Act. What's at stake there, and how could Judge Barrett's nomination affect that outcome?
So this is an interesting case. The Texas trial court that looked at this case held that since the individual mandate is no longer part of the statute, it was repealed. The entire statute is unconstitutional. And I think when most people think of the Affordable Care Act, they think of the individual mandate and they think of the parts having to do with having insurance. But that is a very complicated statute that involved expansion of Medicaid, Medicare. We've been living under it for 10 years, and if that is declared entirely unconstitutional, it's going to wreak havoc on the healthcare industry and on individuals who are increasingly uninsured now. So, and it could cost the state of California and other states a considerable amount of money, money they will not get anymore from the federal government. So it's not just declaring a statute, you know, Obamacare unconstitutional. It is disentangling an incredibly complicated statutory scheme that was designed to address what people correctly perceive was and continues to be a healthcare crisis.
And just in case listeners are wondering, November 10th, that is when the Supreme Court will hear those arguments about the Affordable Care Act, just a week after the election. Another topic that we've heard a lot about is reproductive rights. So what's at stake for all sides with Judge Barrett's nomination?
Well, I think there's, based on what she's written, there's a significant likelihood, not just a possibility, that she will join at least four other members of the court in either drastically reducing the scope of Roe versus Wade or expressly overruling it. I think that is very likely to happen. The impact on California would probably be slight because the ruling is not going to tell California what it can do. It's just going to lift some limits, but it'll have a major impact in southern states. And in certain Midwestern states where there is a strong political constituency for limiting abortion.
One more thing, Professor. You know, a lot of people are concerned that the nomination of Justice Barrett to the Supreme Court for a lifetime appointment could change our country for the foreseeable future. I know you were on with us last week and you made your thoughts on that clear, but can you tell us what you think when it comes to this being something that could just change the court in our country for decades to come?
Well, I definitely think it's going to have an effect. It'll have an immediate effect in, for example, with the Affordable Care Act. I think it's going to make it more difficult for Congress to regulate the healthcare market and to address what is clearly a national crisis. So it's going to have consequences. Whether they will last for multiple decades, I really don't know. We don't know who will be the next resignation. There are two justices in their early 70s, another in his late 60s.
Yeah.
The configuration may change. And
Professor, I'm sorry, I gotta leave it right there. Okay. That's Professor Alan Ides at Loyola Marymount University Law School. Professor, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
All right, we'll turn now to the latest in the ongoing political debates around the 2020 census. Last week, after a federal judge ordered that the 2020 census must keep going through the end of October, the Trump administration appealed that decision late Friday night. The White House has already tried to cut the count short last month, and KPCC reporter Caroline Champlin has been making sense of the census for us this entire time. Caroline, all right, so why is the Trump administration so adamant on keeping the census short?
So when I asked the Census Bureau this question, they told me it's because they're trying to follow the law, which does say that on December 31st, data from the census must be given to the president to determine how many seats in Congress each state gets. But obviously, this isn't a normal year because the census got delayed so many times. And Bureau officials and even President Trump said earlier this year that they would need until 2021 to have all that data finished. But then this summer, the government's position sort of changed. And according to the plaintiffs, there's another story going on here. Do you remember the census memo Trump released in July? He basically wanted undocumented immigrants to be removed from census data before seats in Congress are distributed. That means essentially undocumented folks just wouldn't be represented politically. And shortly after that memo came out, the Trump administration started working on this shorter census plan because, plaintiffs suspect, Trump wants to make sure he's in office when the data is produced. That way he can try to alter it if he wants to. And if this was all delayed until next April in 2021, there's a chance that Trump wouldn't be in office. And of course, the government lawyers have called this all speculation and denied this, but this is what the plaintiffs have sort of hypothesized.
So why is having more time to do the census count important to us here in Los Angeles?
Okay, so LA County is one of the hardest to count regions in the US. And that's part of the reason why the city of LA is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. Those lawyers argued that LA would lose political representation and funding if the census is done poorly. And the risks of an undercount are particularly high here because our region is so hard to count. Researchers say this is because we have so many dense units, renters, immigrants, and people with limited internet access. And the judge acknowledged this difficulty in her order. She said a rush census would cause irreparable harm to the city, and that's why she ordered the census to keep counting people. As expected, the next day, the Trump administration appealed her ruling to the Ninth Circuit to try to get a different outcome. But City Attorney Mike Feuer isn't particularly worried about that challenge. Here's what he said at a press conference after the news came out.
I am very optimistic that this decision is going to withstand scrutiny. I don't think it matters whether the appellate panel reviewing this decision is conservative or liberal, because when it comes to the law, the judge got it right.
So, Caroline, what does all this change mean for people who are actually doing the census outreach in LA to people who haven't done the census on their own?
Right. So lawyers argued that more time would mean more accurate results. And the Census Bureau has said that they will comply and continue counting into October. And that means census takers could follow up at households more often. They'll probably do spot checks to double check that people were actually counted. But from the census advocacy side, this extension is being met with some mixed feelings, actually. I talked to Alejandra Ramirez Zarate with Advancement Project California, and she said they're not even publicizing the new census deadline.
So if we start disseminating this October 31st end date, that's going to create some confusion in our community. We know that it could be overturned on appeal at any moment.
Plus, she told me that her organization has run out of state money to do outreach work because this campaign has stretched on for so much longer than anybody anticipated.
Caroline, what is Ramirez Zarate saying when it comes to it'll create more confusion in her community? Who is she talking about?
Right. So she's sort of talking about this hard to count community and Advancement Project California. They're a racial justice organization. So they're trying to work with the communities that are most likely to be left behind, which largely is communities of color. So when she's talking about that, she's talking about sort of that broader group of people in LA that are considered hard to count.
So, all right. So what happens next?
So there's going to be another hearing in this case because this lawsuit isn't over. The preliminary injunction is sort of just like the first step here. And there's still going to be drama worked out because over the weekend, a census taker in Texas reached out to the court saying their supervisor is still operating according to the September 30th deadline. That's the deadline that the Trump administration created. And that census employee is worried that this breaks the court's order. So today, all the lawyers are supposed to respond to these allegations, and we'll see what comes of that. And in terms of the appeal, we don't really know what that timeline is going to be like, but City Attorney Mike Feuer suggested it's possible it could end up going to the Supreme Court because this issue is just so urgent.
That's KPCC reporter Caroline Champlin. You can read all about why the census matters on our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. Caroline, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
California's community colleges serve over 2 million students in the state. That's more than the UC and the CSUs combined. Enrollment, though, at California's community colleges statewide is declining, and if that continues, the effect on the state's economy could be disastrous. Find out how when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
LAist has a new live event series with the James Beard Foundation. We Are Where We Eat will go behind the scenes of some of your favorite LA restaurants to find out how and why they do what they do. I'm Austin Cross. Join me for the first event where we'll explore how restaurants help make a neighborhood and we'll all have something delicious to eat afterwards. It's May 22nd at the Crawford. Get your tickets now at laist.com/events.
Give me your hands, show me the door. I cannot stand to wait anymore. Somebody say, be what you be. We could be old and cold and dead on the sea.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm Ian Martinez. We're in the thick of the fall semester for California's community colleges. Now, normally students would be learning trades, rushing to make it to class after work or getting the credits they need to transfer to a four-year school. But in this time of mostly online classes, not everyone is eager to return. Last week, we spoke with Los Angeles Community College District Chancellor Francisco Rodriguez, and he worried about students who choose not to re-enroll.
When students leave, particularly lower-income students, they are less likely to return.
Statewide, California Community Colleges is one of the largest higher ed systems in the nation. 116 colleges, more than 2 million students. So what can be done to keep students enrolled? Joining us to discuss this is California Community Colleges Chancellor Eloy Ortiz Oakley. Now, Chancellor, first off, let's get into how enrollment is looking at the community colleges statewide.
Thank you for having me. So at first glance for the fall semester, and this is not every community college, but system-wide, we're somewhere between 5 and 7% down from where we were fall of last year. Our summer enrollments for this year actually came in higher. So we have some anticipation that as colleges continue to roll out their late start semesters, that gap will close. But we also have to remember that even before the pandemic, our enrollment was beginning to get soft because of the demographic shifts in California. So some of this was expected, but some of this obviously is due to the huge impact that these multiple crises are having on our student population.
Chancellor, during the outreach, did you get a sense of what were some of the reasons, or maybe the biggest reason, why community college students were not re-enrolling? What were their biggest fears? What were their biggest obstacles?
So what we've been learning is that in some ways, the obvious issue that's in front of us, which is the huge need that exists in our community. So many of our students were having to work multiple jobs just to make ends meet. And so the schedules that they had to keep to stay enrolled full time was getting difficult. Certainly that was exacerbated with this pandemic and economic crisis. And of course, the response from Washington, D.C. has not helped either, given that the stimulus packages that our students need to continue to remain enrolled full time and not have to seek multiple avenues of economic support, it's not been there. So it is the need that exists, the economic need that our students are having the biggest trouble with, and that's keeping them from being enrolled full time.
I always say, Chancellor, that the typical community college student, that profile ranges widely. It can be an 18-year-old fresh out of high school, a 26-year-old coming back from military service, or even a 40-year-old single parent that's trying to do their best to improve their station in life. Very different from what we would profile, say, a typical UC or even a CSU student. How is that profile tougher in the pandemic to try and grab back into the fold? Because when you've got a range that wide, you've got students that have all kinds of reasons not to be in school.
You're absolutely right. This is the greatest opportunity that our colleges have, and this is the greatest challenge that we face. We have students who have tremendous economic need right now. So whether they directly have lost jobs or lost hours, or they have family members that they have been supporting that have lost a job, that have some sort of health issue, remember that we serve the most under-resourced and most vulnerable communities, communities of color, low-income communities that have been hit the hardest by this pandemic. And that's just the health issues. We also have to remember the economic fallout that has wreaked havoc on these communities and now this period of racial reckoning. So there is so much pressure on students today, particularly students in the most under-resourced communities, that we really have to do a lot more than what we're doing to ensure that we find ways to keep them enrolled.
Talking to California Community Colleges Chancellor Eloy Ortiz Oakley, you mentioned the 5 to 7% decrease in enrollment so far. Can you put that into context for us? How significant of a drop is that? What's the general range and number of students, and where are the declines the sharpest in California?
So the declines are sharpest in some of our more urban communities, like the LA Community College District, for example. We also see similar things happening in some of our rural communities throughout California. You know, we're a big state, very diverse state, but we're seeing similar patterns in areas of the state where we have very high unemployment, a lot of low-income students. So we can see that their struggles are similar, even though they're coming from very diverse parts of the state.
When it comes to the students that are enrolled right now in California community colleges, some of the ones that, like the ones that didn't enroll, that struggle with homelessness or food insecurity, what can you tell us about what the state is doing to support these students who are in class right now?
The California Community Colleges itself has created a lot more flexibility for students. Our colleges, as you mentioned earlier, are by and large going to continue to be fully remote, fully online into the spring. We want to make it as easy as possible for students to stay enrolled. We know that many of our students have family, have children who are in the K-12 system. Many of those students are having to be educated at home. So we have to recognize the challenges that they face and become much more flexible. The state of California has also provided additional support for our most vulnerable students. They have provided support in terms of a block grant to each college to help with COVID-related issues, to help with emergency aid, to help with getting technology into the hands of students, to help with portable Wi-Fi. We have also gathered all of the internet service providers in the state of California and made it very clear to them that we need our lowest income students to have access to free or very low cost broadband. I think by and large, they're responding, but it's really pointed out a challenge that we have in the state.
Yeah, that's the big issue, especially right here in the LA area. The district estimates that 30,000 students don't have access to computers or reliable internet. If that isn't something that can be fixed, Chancellor, I mean, what are the chances of keeping the students that are enrolled now, keeping them enrolled into the spring?
Yeah, no, that is a huge challenge. And that is a challenge not only for community college students, but for K-12 students. So we're working very closely with State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tony Thurman. We recognize that the communities that we serve, our most vulnerable communities, also are impacted at the K-12 level. So we're trying very hard to make it easier for students to get access to quality broadband and to the equipment that they need. We've also highlighted this with our congressional delegation. It is critically important that Congress pass another federal stimulus to help support our lowest income students. They have lost unemployment benefits. They continue to struggle to go to school, to feed their families. So we need help from both the California legislature and, most importantly, from the federal government to help our students continue to stay enrolled. This is not just an issue that's important to our students. This is an issue that's important to our economy as a state and as a nation, because if these students fall through the cracks, we are going to be picking up the pieces for many years to come.
Chancellor, I'm going to ask this next question. With a lot of experience in my background, I went to 4 community colleges in the LA area before I went to Cal State Northridge for my degree. So I know that when a community college student decides not to enroll, it is very, very difficult for them to come back. In fact, it's less likely that they're going to return at all to school. So what's the outlook on the future? Is there a chance that these enrollment numbers will start to tick back up again?
I'm very confident that they will begin to tick back up for several reasons. One is each college is seeing this problem as a major crisis. And so I know colleges like the LA Community College District colleges are reaching out directly to students who we've lost. We've also launched a stay enrolled campaign throughout the state with everything from radio ads to direct intervention in communities about the importance of staying enrolled in college. We've also partnered with the CSU and the UC to continue to echo this message. And then finally, we know that many working adults have lost their jobs and may or may not be coming back to the same job. So we are also highlighting and attracting adult workers who may not have been enrolled in college, but who need to find a path forward back into the economy. We are focused on all of these angles. We know how important it is to our students. And so I do think as the semester continues to unwind, as more certainty is created in our communities, that we will begin to see these students coming back. I'm very hopeful that that happens.
That's California Community Colleges Chancellor Eloy Ortiz Oakley and his dog that you heard there in the background. Chancellor, thank you very much for the time.
Absolutely. It's great being with you.
Pro Protests are an important tool that Americans use to express themselves. I mean, we've seen and heard that all summer long, and the protest spirit goes back to our nation's beginnings. While there will be people who don't agree with every protest, there's been a troubling trend of people using their cars to disagree. Find out how when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Flash flood warnings across Coachella Valley.
The journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm Erin Stone, the climate emergency reporter at LAist.
Desalination really should be considered as a last resort.
I bring you the information and connections you need to understand, cope with, and prepare for the changes caused by the climate emergency.
Potential for what's called land spouts, which are basically like mini tornadoes.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Here in Southern California and around the country, we're continuing to see instances of cars and trucks driving into protesters and in some cases striking them. At least two people have died, one in Seattle, one in Bakersfield, although the circumstances in those cases are still not clear. The latest example of this phenomenon happened Saturday as Trump supporters and counter-protesters were demonstrating in Yorba Linda. And the LAPD says it's investigating two incidents involving vehicles that drove into a crowd that was marching in honor of Breonna Taylor in Hollywood last week. KPCC's Robert Garoba has been following this. Robert, so what happened in Yorba Linda over the weekend?
Well, according to the Orange County Sheriff's Department and what we can see from video posted to social media, a car drove into a crowd of protesters and hit two people. A number of groups, including one called Caravan for Justice, organized a march against police brutality, but counter-protesters showed up. The Sheriff's Department said it had reports of altercations and people with weapons, so it ordered the crowd to disperse. And then later that day, a car drove through the crowd and hit at least two people. They suffered major injuries but are expected to survive. The sheriff's department said it believes the driver of the vehicle, a 40-year-old woman from Long Beach, was part of the Caravan for Justice demonstration, but we have not been able to confirm that separately. The department said it would charge the driver with attempted murder and assault with a deadly weapon.
Robert, any idea about why the driver drove into the crowd?
No, we haven't had an opportunity to learn more about what led up to the incident. There is a still photo of the car afterwards that shows that the front window had been smashed, and video shows people smashing the rear window as the car drove through the crowd. So we can kind of see that from social media.
What about the other incident last Thursday in Hollywood?
Well, from videos posted again to social media, it's clear that a large pickup truck drove through a crowd of protesters who were marching east on Sunset Boulevard. I talked with photojournalist Christian Monterosa, who witnessed the incident. He said the pickup was driving westbound and he heard the crowd start to get agitated. Here's what he told me.
And I looked over and I saw that the truck was refusing to stop. And I saw several protesters in front of the truck trying to get it to stop. And there was a woman caught in front of the truck. And so when the truck hit the brakes, obviously her momentum kept going and she fell backwards and hit her head on the pavement.
And we do have a photo Monterosa took. It's on our website, LAist.com. You can see in the videos that the truck then speeds off as people rush towards it, getting way too close to other protesters as it goes. LAPD says the woman was transported to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries.
Talking to KPCC's Robert Garoba. Robert, any indication as to why a driver would do this?
It's not completely clear. Monterosa said it wasn't clear to him that any protesters had thrown anything at the truck. He also said there were other cars around that yielded to the marchers and waited for them to pass. But the LAPD said, at least in its preliminary investigation, it found that protesters had beaten the truck with sticks and tried to open the door, and that the driver struck the protester as he was trying to get away. Officers stopped the driver after he had sped off from the scene. They say he was cooperative and he was released pending the outcome of a hit-and-run investigation.
Now, regrettably, this is not the first time we've seen incidents like this year, right?
Definitely not. Across the nation, there have been dozens of incidents of drivers hitting protesters. There's one researcher at the University of Chicago who said between late May and early September, cars drove into protests more than 100 times. The researcher said he doesn't have enough information to determine intent in a lot of the cases. So it's possible, at least in some cases, the driver was just trying to get from point A to point B rather than trying to hurt people. At the same time, he said he did see evidence of malicious intent in at least 43 incidents. He said 39 drivers of those have been charged.
39, Robert, that sounds like a lot.
Yeah, and you know, here's what appears to be one example of that. Back in May, a man from San Marino was arrested after authorities say he intentionally drove his vehicle into a crowd of protesters in Pasadena. The crowd scattered and no one was hurt. Police found a loaded gun and a bunch of ammo in his car when they searched it. He's now facing a federal charge of illegally obtaining and transporting firearms. The complaint against him says he used his family's vineyard in Lodi as a training camp to prepare to engage in civil disorder. And just today, we heard that a federal judge ruled that this particular guy is a danger to the community and will remain in jail pending his trial.
You know, whenever I see this, it reminds me of Charlottesville in 2017 when that car killed a woman in the crowd. Yep. You know, does it seem like there's anything the police can try and do to prevent this from happening going forward?
I've covered several large protests this year and haven't seen anyone hit by a moving vehicle, but it's not like the police are blocking off every intersection that marchers go through. So there's, you know, a ton of opportunity for anyone really to get their vehicle right up close to protesters. Last Wednesday night, I was downtown with a crowd of hundreds of people, and there was a motorcycle rolling along right next to me at one point. And sometimes it can be hard to tell, you know, which cars are there for the protest and which are not. I asked the LAPD last week if it's considered deploying traffic officers on the perimeter of protest marches to better keep cars away from people, but we have not heard back on that yet.
All right, that's KPCC's Robert Garova. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now we'll turn our attention south, where there's been a deadly police shooting and public school teachers threatened to strike amid plans to reopen. It's time for our weekly check-in. The headlines out of Orange County, and joining us as always is Nick Gerter, reporter at the nonprofit news site, The Voice of OC. Nick, there was a dramatic turn of events in San Clemente last week. An OC sheriff's deputy shot and killed a homeless man, Kurt Reinhold. Reinhold was black, and the incident happened on the same day that charges were announced in the Breonna Taylor case, so tensions were running high. First, Nick, recap what we know about what happened in San Clemente.
Yeah, so there's still a lot of information to come out on this, but it centers on the shooting of Reinhold last Wednesday in the early afternoon in front of the Hotel Miramar in San Clemente. And the background on this is the sheriff's deputies in that city were doing a day of stepped-up enforcement of pedestrians and bicyclists for alleged traffic violations like jaywalking or riding bikes against traffic. And the department says two of their homeless outreach deputies came up across Reinhold and that he was jaywalking in the street, a black homeless man, and that when deputies came up to him, they got into a physical altercation. There's video of the deputies tackling Reinhold to the ground amid that altercation. And when he was on the ground, sheriff's officials say that he tried to grab a deputy's gun, with the deputy then shooting Reinhold twice and killing him. There was a news conference later on, and the department passed out a grainy image captured from a surveillance video that they say shows Reinhold reaching for the gun. It is a pretty grainy photo, and still a lot to come out on this. And the shooting's under investigation by both the sheriff's department and the DA's office.
And then tensions ramped up right after that. Tell us about the protests that sprung up in response and the response by local officials to the protests.
Yeah, so there's a few dozen protesters who came out in San Clemente to protest the shooting. Also, counter-protesters opposing those protesters. A lot of sheriff's deputies showing up. Ultimately, the San Clemente City Council called an emergency meeting on Thursday and declared a 9 p.m. curfew in specific areas of the city. They boarded up the City Hall meeting chambers, but most of the marches ended by about 7 p.m. Before the curfew. And the shooting also prompted questions about the sheriff's department's role in mental health and homeless outreach. When deputies approach a homeless person struggling with mental illness, oftentimes there are no mental health nurses or other healthcare workers to help with that conversation. And a lot of local activists and officials, including Sheriff Don Barnes, have said they want to see more resources put into having mental health response teams handle crisis situations as opposed to only having deputies in those situations. And the sheriff noted that often comes down to funding. And when we've reviewed the spending decisions over the last decade, the County Board of Supervisors has shifted tens of millions of dollars that they control away from public health while shifting that into the sheriff's department.
Talking to Nick Gerda, reporter for The Voice of OC. All right, let's shift to the classrooms, where the tension continues to mount over reopening schools and the worries about coronavirus outbreaks. The Orange County's health department is still digging in on its heels about not being the one to report outbreaks, leaving that up to individual districts. And it's become a real issue of transparency and the lack of collaboration on coming up with plans that that involves everyone. So is that a pretty universal thing throughout Orange County, Nick?
Yeah, so each of the 28 school districts is different, but in a couple of the largest districts, we're seeing a lot of concern and frustration among teachers who are concerned about their health as classrooms reopen, as well as parents who want their kids back in school as well. So a lot of debate happening. Some of the larger districts like Santa Ana Unified and Anaheim Union High School District are pushing off openings for a few more weeks at least. But in Capistrano Unified, for example, they're moving to reopen. And there were a lot of teachers who came out to their public meeting of the school board last week and raised a lot of concerns, saying that administrators haven't listened to them when they're drawing up their plans to reopen classrooms. So there's a lot of concern about that, particularly about a lack of regular testing to identify outbreaks.
And now we're hearing possibly a strike. Tell us about how serious that might be.
Yeah, there's been a growing talk about this by some teachers. We haven't seen anything official yet come out, but my colleagues are continuing to track that, and we'll definitely have the latest at voiceofoc.org.
All right, finally, let's wrap up on Angel Stadium, because tomorrow the deal to sell the stadium and the land around it will be finalized. Anaheim will sell it to the owner of the Angels, Artie Moreno. And while the first price tag last December was $325 million, Nick, now it's going for $150 million. I mean, if I'd have known they'd have discounted it like that, Nick, I'd have, put in a bid. The Voice of OC hosted a forum about it last week, and some people participating were not pleased. Why not?
Yeah, my colleague Spencer Custodio has a story on this today. There's been a lot of criticism of the proposed stadium deal as having a lack of transparency around how they got that price tag down from $325 million to $150 million. That's the amount that the Angels would pay the public or the city of Anaheim for that public land and the stadium. So my colleagues held a forum on it last week, and they invited everyone from state legislators to city council members. And several people were very critical of the secret way the council has been holding its discussions about the land deal and knocking down the price. My colleagues invited the Angels and the Anaheim Chamber of Commerce and as well as city council members who support the deal to join the panel. None of them opted to publicly defend the stadium deal. And it goes to the city council tomorrow, where they're voting on whether to finalize the sale to Angels and the owner, Artie Moreno.
I mean, it's a baseball stadium, Nick. It's over half off. I mean, that's a great deal for anyone, right? Nick Gerda, reporter for The Voice of OC. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ed.
All right, one of the longest living residents of L.A. County is a black woman who was born the same year women won the right to vote, 101 years old. She worked at the Pentagon and then became a Long Beach Reserve police officer. And while she lived through the civil rights movement, she says there is one big difference between what was going on then to what is happening now. She's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
How to LA is our love letter to Los Angeles. We'll tell you where to get a yummy torta, a bowl of congee, and of course, a burger.
It's a beef sausage blend, fried egg, grilled onions, and then raspberry jam.
What hiking trails to check out.
This feels like we're out in the mountains.
And where to take in some culture.
Limerick Park, they've been fostering jazz for decades.
LA's a big place with a lot going on, so we got you. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah. And we go high. They go low. We go.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and most places where you get your podcasts. I'm E. Martinez. They say that history makes the best teacher, and if that's the case, our next guest would certainly know. At the age of 101, longtime Los Angeles resident Winnie Carter has lived through some of the most pivotal moments in our country's history and is no stranger to unprecedented times, which is why we wanted to sit down with her to discuss her incredible life and the lessons that she's learned along the way. It certainly has not been easy.
I was one of eight children, and we had a pretty rough time. Both my parents died when I was 5 years old, so we grew up in foster homes and whatnot until my older sister was able to take over. But she got us through high school. You know, we didn't understand poverty then, because we were just growing up and we didn't realize that we were poor. We just knew that this was a way of life for us, for our family.
Winnie was born the same year many women won the right to vote, and though she grew up as a black child, it was not until she became an adult and took her first job that she witnessed the widespread discrimination against African Americans in the United States.
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. We had friends, Jewish friends, we had Italian friends. Race didn't mean anything to us. We just grew up. We played games together. We went to school together. And race wasn't really an outstanding topic at that time.
So was there ever a time or a specific moment that you remember, Winnie, because you mentioned how when you were a kid growing up, race wasn't an issue, but did you ever come to a moment where you realized that in America it was?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes. When I started working at the Pentagon, my roommate in Washington lived in Savannah, Georgia. And she invited me to her home, and that's when I realized that race was a big thing, because I had to sit in the back of the train, and it was a hot day, the smoke was blowing in, and, you know, it was just one of those things. And that's when I realized that all the signs we passed it for colored only and things like that. And, you know, then I realized that, you know, there was a difference, and whites were considered rich and powerful. And blacks were considered slaves, really. But that was my first experience with segregation.
So, Winnie, when you made that realization, I mean, you're working at the Pentagon. You're working right in the heart of the United States government, and you realize that there's this difference between, you know, people. I mean, how did that make you feel?
Even when I went to the Pentagon, we were segregated there. We had to go by bus. We had to sit in the back of the bus. It was a really growing up experience and a rude awakening, I should say. It was so pointed. It made you feel kind of second class, really second class. In fact, when we went to the Pentagon, we felt very special and very grown up.
Yeah.
And I was 21 then, and to me, this was a big thing. And then to make you feel that you were second class, that was something else, you know. So we did feel... And so we were a different race altogether.
You know, all summer long, Winnie, we've seen black Americans and other people of color protesting the inequities that exist in our society. But what do you think, Winnie, is different about today's marches compared to what you saw in the 60s?
In the 60s, people just became aware, really, that they could get out there and voice their dissent. People now are more determined, and they're willing to die for it, really. Before they were really ready to talk about it, but now they're ready to get out and fight for it. It's now or never. That's what the situation is today.
Now, Winnie, I wanted to ask you about what you did post-retirement. You became a reserve police officer in Long Beach. Winnie, what was that work like, and why did you want to do it?
I wanted to do it. I was telling you, at that time, my daughter was dating. All sorts of young men were coming to the house to visit her, and I didn't approve of it. I was volunteering at the senior center then, and we had a speaker that came in recruiting for reserve police officers and asking us. I was a block captain. They asked all the block captains to recruit in their neighborhood and see if they could get people to sign up for reserve police officers. So I went out door to door on my street, and I couldn't get anybody to sign up. So I reported back to the police officers, And I told them I couldn't get anyone to sign up. So they said, I asked them, how old do you have to be? And they said, oh, there's no age limit. I said, well, sign me up, because I felt so bad that I couldn't recruit anyone. So they signed me up to be a reserve police officer. And I was in my 60s then. And that was when I became a police officer. Then that deterred all those young men from knocking on my door and trying to date my daughter.
Winnie, when you look and see the current relationship that the community has with police, when we're talking about black and brown citizens and the relationship and how they view police, are you surprised that we are where we are? There just seems to be so much mistrust on both sides.
I know, and it's sad. It really is. The mistrust comes because a lot of people have been hurt by the police, and unnecessarily, I would say, or driving when well black and all like that, and people feel that they have to show, they're showing their resentment to the fact that they were treated unfairly.
Winnie, I wanted to go back for a second, because I remember I brought up how you were born the year that women won the right to vote. When were you first able to vote, and what was that experience like for you?
I was very anxious about voting. Because to me, it meant, you know, I was part of America then. I was able to express my opinion. I was able to put my opinion in, on the ballot. Now I'm part of the community. I'm part of the culture. It was a very big thing for me when I became 18 and was able to vote. I don't think I've ever missed any election.
No kidding. Wow. So if I've done my math correctly, your first presidential vote would have been Franklin Roosevelt?
Yes, because I was 21 then when I started the Pentagon, and Roosevelt was president then, yes.
Wow. So, yeah. So ever since then, back then, even a few years before, you have never missed a chance to vote.
That's for sure. I don't think I've ever missed a chance to vote.
Given that voting has meant so much to Winnie, I asked her what she would say to those who are voting for the first time or for whom voting is not a priority.
I say that they are losing their chance to express their feelings. They are losing their chance to maintain their citizenship. They're losing their chance to say, to keep this country on the right course. They have an opportunity to vote, which was hard-earned, and they should take advantage of it, because it didn't come easy. And to just be lackadaisical about it, to me, that's a very bad thing.
Winnie, looking back on your life, 101 years old, what are you most proud of?
What am I most proud of?
Yeah.
I told you I grew up an orphan, and everything was handed down to us. I've always said since I became adult, I was going to give back for all that was done for us. And I'm most proud of the fact that I have done that. I just do whatever I can to be of service. That's what I'd like to be remembered for, that I've been of service to the community.
That's Winnie Carter, a former transcriptionist for the Pentagon and a retired Long Beach police reservist at 101. She's one of the oldest living residents of Los Angeles. All right, if you missed any part of Take Two, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.
The Colorado River is running dry. Water may not reach millions of people.
So if there's no water, there's no water for everybody.
It's up to California's lead negotiator, a 28-year-old.
This is a historic thing coming.
And 6 other negotiators to find a solution.
I want an agreement that lessens the pain for all of us, not just some of us.
Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water deal maker, wherever you get podcasts.